Okay, well, you don't have to turn your Bibles yet, because you're not going to have what I'm getting ready to do sitting in front of you quite yet. Let me start this way. This has been a real eventful week. Of course, it's also an eventful weekend. We're leading up to the time of once upon a time, the celebration of Independence Day. More people today know it as the 4th of July, because that way they don't have to remember what it actually celebrates. And increasingly, I guess, it bugs me, but more and more people don't have a clue as to what the declaration that they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor for was all about. So this does seem like an appropriate way to introduce the news anyway. There were stories earlier in the week about how the FBI was saying, be afraid, be very, very afraid. Booga, booga, booga. We don't have any actual actionable intelligence. Sick. No pun intended. And that's in spite of the fact that they're listening, monitoring everything, because it's all about terror. But nevertheless, they're saying, well, with no particular information and no particular reason, we are trying to tell everybody, be very afraid of some kind of a terror attack this weekend. Now, it makes sense to me, because if you're looking for a false flag, that's probably the time. But this is the story that I wanted to begin with, because it bugs me. New York Congress critter, a guy named Peter King, was on a Fox News show. What day was this? Wednesday night, spreading his own brand of fear and panic, telling viewers nationwide that officials in New York are worried that there's going to be a dirty bomb attack this weekend in New York. So basically, when it comes to trying to panic people, speaking to Megyn Kelly, King took things to a whole new level. Quote, you wouldn't see the nuclear explosion devices being used the way they are if this were just a routine warning. Did you say nuclear? Said Kelly. Yes, that's a big concern here in New York, he said. The dirty bomb. That's why so much money's been spent to put in explosive detection devices. Now, this is the same guy who is also really, really big on NSA. If there's anything that Big Brother can do to tap your phones, he's for it. And he's also enclosed, if there's more aggressive surveillance, you name it, he's all for it. It's the kind of thing that pretty well, I guess, tells the story right now. Now, here's another one. Now, I see the comment on the screen. I think that's a good point. We've not been given a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And that's true. It is also true that the most repeated command in Scripture is fear not. And that is very important. We're supposed to fear Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and not man. And it's a different kind of fear entirely when we understand who the real boss is. I mention these things, of course, most of the regulars here know this, because we are told all kinds of things, common advice, like we're supposed to know the times and the seasons, be like the men of Issachar who did that. It's all about being aware of what's going on, so we know the ways of the wicked one, of the adversary, of those who are opposed to Yah, but we're not to fear, we're just to be aware of things. And speaking of be aware, here's another one. Now, this one, I'm going to ask a question here up front. I'm just curious. Give me some twos in this case, if you have seen or heard about telephone outages, internet outages, or anything else since the last Shabbat. And I'm just curious. Ones, if you haven't, if everything's just been fine and there hasn't been any problems with the internet or the phones or whatever. But twos, if things have been quiet for any period of time and there have been any outages of various kinds. I'm seeing quite a few. Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Well, let me tell you, we have had two outages this week, right? Is that right? Am I losing track? Two outages, maybe three at least, with the telephone service all over the valley, as far as we can tell. Some of them at least were fairly widespread. Now, we have some pretty unreliable service anyway, but nevertheless, that's like the fourth or fifth in less than a month. And we've been out here in the boondocks for a long, long time. This is the worst series of outages that we've ever seen. What caught my attention was that we also had this week... this story from Reuters says that three major cables delivering internet service to the Sacramento area in California, Sacramento, were severed earlier this week in what appears to be a coordinated attack, said the service provider. The FBI is investigating. It was the latest in a long string of cable cuts in the San Francisco Bay Area of late. said, you know, one of their special agents, latest one, was, you know, 40 miles east of San Francisco. They're not telling us anything more. And what caught my eye about that, of course, is not just the other outages, but there was a big one in Arizona a few months back. I think I remember talking about this one. And it turns out that originally the story was not to worry, you know, a truck hit a power pole or some such bogus stuff, BS. And then later on, better sources revealed, no, don't kid yourself, that wasn't it at all. This was a coordinated attack. It was done by insiders with special knowledge because the cables were cut way out in the middle of nowhere. They were buried very deeply, couldn't even find them without special equipment, and they were armored. So it took major cutting devices, highly sophisticated ones, to both dig them up and to cut them. And when I see all of this stuff, you know, my somewhat cynical mind begins to say, almost like somebody is softening people up for what might be coming. So just be aware of it anyway.
You were asking about Jade Helm in Colorado. I said, no, what's that replacement thing that they're doing
now? Oh, they got different names. I forget. Yeah.
Something about the dam?
Colorado basically said no to Jade Helm. I forget what it's called. Operation Show 'em Who's Boss or something like that. Basically, on the eastern slope, I-25 corridor, there have been reports after reports of everything from massive train loads of heavy equipment, military vehicles, MRAPs, including artillery, and so forth. Yeah, Linda's seen it. We've got lots of neighbors that have been over to places like Pueblo and down at Pinyon Canyon, is a place where they stole a bunch of land. Pinyon Canyon is the place, but that's not the name of the exercises. But in any case, this stuff's going on all over the place. Colorado said no to Jade Helm, so Big Brother said, all right, you say no, well, we'll stick something else in there instead. Ha ha. Turns out, though, that although Jade Helm is getting all the PR, it's a lot bigger than that, and there are mobilizations. There's not a day go by I don't see tons and tons of reports and videos, people saying, look, you know, there's train cars, massive train cars full of stuff. Heavy equipment all over the place. So it's quite interesting, at least, and it certainly does, leading up to the week of the Declaration of Independence, remind folks of how, you know, once upon a time there was posse comitatus, there was a constitution, there were all kinds of things that, well, I'm going to read it. Okay. I got this sitting here just because I think it's appropriate and sad but true. Remember when Jefferson and the founders put down a list of grievances against King George? He has erected a multitude of new offices, sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people, all kinds of good stuff in here. But this one is funny. For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, he has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislature. Oh, well, that was back then, before we were able to kick King George out and replace him with King Barack. Let's talk about a couple of other things. The real impetus for so much of this, I think, is economic. Most of you probably heard about Greece this week. Give me some ones if you heard about Greece. Twos if you're not aware of what's going on there. But the bank holiday that the powers that be, what's called the Troika, the European Central Bank and the other banksters that run Europe nowadays, everybody's heard about Greece. All right. Anyway, they were trying to get a bank run started several weeks ago. It took a while to get people kind of warmed up to it, but this week they did shut the banks down. They shut down the ATMs for a little while, and then when they opened them back up again, they dropped the amount of cash that people could take out to a measly 60 euros, not quite 70 bucks. And now I see this story that I'm looking at. I just printed this off this morning. As of this morning, according to the Telegraph in London, they dropped it from 60 euros down to 50 euros because they're running out of 20s. And here's the other part of the story. Greece, says the Telegraph, is sliding into a full-blown national crisis. Final cash reserves of the banking system evaporate literally by the hour. And they're down to only something like half a billion euros, but that's not much different, in cash reserves as the entire Greek economy crashes. Now, at the end of last week, before the bank holiday, they were taking half a billion or more out every single day. So that's not enough cash in the whole country to last them a day at this point. Of course, so they're prohibiting it anyway. The other thing that's happened is that the local chambers of commerce people are saying, look, lenders are running out of money. Industries are shutting down. entire Greek companies have been excluded from electronic transfers to the rest of Europe, so the Greek business community is unable to import anything. They can't get raw materials, and so their factories and industries are shutting down, and this is the height of tourist season, too, so they got no tourism. It's almost like the Eurozone is saying, ha ha, we will show you who is boss. We've already basically gutted your economy with our debt bomb. Now we're going to just literally destroy you. But that's not all. This week we had kind of a double whammy. On Monday, it was China versus Greece. And it turns out that the Chinese stock crash continues. They had the biggest crash in 19 years. Things reopened, limit down. It was an ugly week for Chinese stocks all over the board, and China was basically telling people, don't panic, we have a plunge protection team just like those Americans, and our banks will buy all the stocks too. Okay, we had twos, but now we got ones, right? So if Greece isn't bad enough, China, the world's economic engine, at least that's the story, is also having some major problems. And China has been entering their own form of QE. They've dropped their benchmark lending rate to a record low and doing all kinds of things essentially to try to pump up the markets. And so on every front, it was an interesting week. Here's another story that came out. Didn't get a lot of coverage. Zero Hedge does some yeoman's work in all of this stuff. J.P. Morgan. One of the world's biggest crooks. Yeah, did I say that? You betcha. They are the bankster, de tutte banksters when it comes to derivatives and to controlling the crooked casinos, selling short gold and silver and all of that kind of stuff. Well, this week, a piece from Zero Hedge says anyway, J.P. Morgan just cornered the commodity derivative market, and this time they have proof. It's about something called the OCC, which is another one of these regulators, Quarterly Bank Report on Derivatives. This sounds like pretty dry stuff, but the key thing is this. Literally, in 1 year, and in one quarter of 1 year now, the amount of commodities that J.P. Morgan controls that have a 1 year or less maturity has exploded to a record almost $4 trillion. And what's really funny is their commodity derivative book exploded from just $131 billion, which sounds like a lot, to a never-before-seen a total, again, almost $4 trillion. They went from having 50% of the total commodity holdings in the market to over 96% in one quarter. So literally. And if you look at the graph, it looks like just a great big, you know, pop right there from little teeny numbers to huge numbers in one quarter. What's going on? All of this looks abnormal, and something is fishy. Of course, J.P. Morgan has been buying physical silver and selling short silver, so you got to scratch your head, basically, says another piece here. Everybody knows, if they're paying attention, J.P. Morgan and the Fed are pretty much joined at the hip, and the story is that they've now amassed, J.P. Morgan, something like 350 million ounces of silver. And we know that China and Russia have been buying lots of gold. J.P. Morgan has increased their derivatives by that huge amount in just one quarter. So it looks like they are sitting on the paper prices of gold and silver, attacking the markets and preparing for, well, something big. And while they're extricating themselves from their underwater position and a lot of the stuff that they've sold short can't deliver. So it sounds, in other words, like a lot of inside baseball financial machinations. But the thing people need to remember is, when things like Greece blow up, and when the world's economic engine, China, has a stock market collapse and they can't keep people in the markets and they've been basically telling them, oh, this is the way to riches, and all of a sudden things get really ugly on so many fronts, well, it's time to be aware of the times and the seasons. Earlier this week, of course, you probably know the Dow fell after the Greek news, 350 points. Biggest one-day decline in 2 years. In Europe, stocks got smashed. We've already talked about China. Greek stocks were down 18% in the overseas markets earlier this week. Chinese stocks are off 20%. And finally, the Bank for International Settlements, BIS, one of the big banksters in the world manipulation scheme, has come out with a new report saying that the central banks of the world are defenseless, that's a quote, to stop the next major global financial crisis. So no wonder Jade Helm needs to have some troops on the streets. They're looking to see that what happened in Greece and is still going on in Greece can literally happen everywhere. And there's a comment on the screen about the dominoes. I've been joking about the dominoes for years, right? The pig's dominoes. Greece falls, then Portugal, Italy, Spain, so forth. The dominoes have already fallen. And then they just sold them more debt. Hitched them up to another set of chains that they can't bear. Set the domino back up again and said, I dare you, knock it over again. And they did. And then they propped it up and sold them more debt and knocked it over again. And now we got the big Greek referendum coming up over over this weekend to see whether the Greeks will say, heck no or not. I'll do this story next, too. This is from a fellow named Raoul Ilargi Maiger, and evidently he's in Greece. And he says, now that the Greek deal has completely fallen apart, the IMF comes out with a report saying that the one thing we weren't going to allow is the only thing that has to happen, a major debt restructuring in Greece. So he asks, why did you go through 5 months of so-called negotiations with Greece in which you refused to even talk about restructuring, only to come up with a paper that now says they desperately need to be restructured, but you won't have a deal that includes that? In other words, for whole months, the Troika has refused to talk debt relief. And who's kidding who? Was this negotiations? The Europeans, he said, that are watching this need to understand that the EU has no qualms when it comes to declaring war on one of its own member states. And that could be you. The rest of Europe, says the story. What happens to Greece is happening to all of Europe because that's the result of the Union. And, of course, that's not all. There's more. Another story here says the whole West is collapsing. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts talks about the rigged financial markets. I've quoted him a lot lately. He, too, is pointing at another one, the COMEX silver market, J.P. Morgan's paper tiger. And open interest in silver futures, notes Dr. Roberts, is currently 1 billion ounces. Remember, J.P. Morgan has accumulated a third of that in physical as they basically put the screws to everybody else, sell paper, and then take delivery of the real stuff. No fools there. They know darn well what they're doing, and it's good money, I guess, if you can get away with it. Everybody else that would try that would no doubt end up in jail. But this 1 billion ounces of paper silver stands against 57 million of actual physical silver outside of J.P. Morgan that's actually available to delivery. So this story here says, never in the history of the known universe has any commodities future market experienced a dislocation this extreme between paper and the real physical stuff that underlies it that's available to deliver. And then, note what's happening with TPP. Tyranny, public and private. All of these pieces just are, and why it is that we can see so many pieces begin to come together. A lot of folks, of course, are suggesting, and I would be among them, that the time to really watch is the fall. Does that mean something's definitely going to come apart? No, but it could come apart tomorrow. And between now and the fall, there's a whole lot of likelihood that something will break. Break bad enough that they can't even continue to cover it up. Here's another one I'll ask a question about. For those of you that do FBI book, Facebook, did you see all the little Kool-Aid drinkers that had their rainbow pictures of all their friends on FBI book this week? Give me some ones if you know what I'm talking about. Twos if you didn't. I won't waste a lot of time on this. We'll just see. But it looks like a lot of folks did. So far, anyway. All right, here's the propaganda from the Daily Mail out of the UK. Did you change your Facebook picture to a rainbow flag to celebrate pride? Yeah, the sycophants and propagandists at Facebook, led by what's the guy? Mark Zuckerberg, that's the scumbag at the head of this thing, put the Celebrate Pride tool on his personal Facebook page, so they made it real easy. You could take your pictures in Facebook and put a little rainbow thing up there so that you could engage in peer pressure and show all of your friends that you were just ready to line up and drink Kool-Aid with the rest of them to celebrate the Supreme Court's mandate of licensed same-sex marriage. Within a few hours of the Celebrate Pride tool launching, more than a million people had drunk the Kool-Aid and changed their profile photos. And, of course, the really interesting part is Didn't take long for various social scientists like the MIT network scientist Cesar Hidalgo to come out and say, this is a propaganda control experiment. Facebook's doing it. I'm sure Google and NSA are watching carefully to see how well their propaganda is playing with the masses out there and how it is they can control and manipulate opinions, giving them, quote, unprecedented insight into how to influence people. Now, here's the funny line. A spokesperson for Facebook denied that they were doing anything of the sort and told the Daily Mail, the point of this tool is not to get information about people, unquote. No, folks, the point is also to propagandize them. So this is where things are at in, you know, literally the Western world in these days, because that story came out of Great Britain. The other one that got so much press, you got all these sycophants in the media saying, you know, we will allow all kinds of things except a reminder of U.S. history that involved a time of rebellion when the southern states decided, if you're not going to honor the Constitution, we're going to leave. And so there's a big stink about the Confederate flag, probably a lot more propaganda than it even deserves mentioning. But this one caught my eye earlier in the week. There was a fellow down in Louisiana that tried to get Walmart. Remember, they're one of the politically correct folks like Amazon that had said, we're not going to sell Confederate flags. I mentioned this last week. Now, we'll sell bondage and discipline equipment so that you can take various, slaves like girls and women, you can tie them up and you can put gags in their mouth. We'll sell you that. And we'll even advertise it, saying it's about your little slave doll. But, we don't want a symbol that might be associated with something politically incorrect. So anyway, this guy took in a cake to Walmart. He asked him to bake this cake with a Confederate flag underneath, and on top it said Heritage, not Hate. And Walmart said, Achtung, not here. And he left, and then came back the next day and said, okay, how about this nice Iranian flag with a bunch of Arabic on it? And they said, no problem. They made the cake up for him right away. So real terror, fine. Reminders of history, not so fine. I'm going to skip this one. We'll skip all the rest of that, because we need to talk about some of the other things that are going on. The beginning of the ending sequence says one story. Got another story here from a guy that I've always admired, and that's Jim Willey, talking about the demise of the dollar. Basically, his latest story is just, hey, it's a done deal. Stick a fork in it. The aggressive defense of the U.S. dollar continues to include criminal activity on a widespread scale that the world has never seen before. The money war is going on, and the U.S. is literally demanding at gunpoint that its allies support the fiat global currency, even though doing so guarantees a structural collapse of the entire world system and an economic breakdown. And meanwhile, the banksters are having an increasingly difficult time trying to control and to conceal the damage, the corrosion, the ruin, and the breakdown that's going on, while the Chinese are buying gold and preparing for replacement of the dollar. They'll liberate gold, he says, when they feel like it, not a moment before. As long as they can continue to get the real stuff, they'll let the manipulation in the U.S. markets go on. So a lot of things to bear in mind, and I'll wrap it up by saying, I talked a lot last week about the Supreme Court decision and the fact that it was all about licensed marriage. Every week we talk here about licensed churches, licensed marriage. It all goes together. If you take the king's money, you play the king's tune. And it still bugs me how many of these sycophants don't understand, or at least refuse to admit the obvious, that if you license something, and if you're the one that issues the licenses, you control it. And Scripture warns about that over and over and over again. You can't serve two masters. Well, we got a whole lot of 501c3 churches and licensed marriage that are beginning to figure it out, even if they don't want to admit it. Because the court, you got to give them credit for one thing. They are teaching Americans who they serve, and it's not the God of the Bible. I saw another funny story that I think will put the ribbons on this one. Did the Supreme Court of the United States and their licensed marriage decision just nullify licensed concealed carry prohibitions nationwide? And my response is, of course not. Hell, they change the rules whenever they feel like it. So, don't think for a second. A friend of mine once said, when I was doing a radio show, he said, Mark, slow down, calm down. You're having an attack of logic. And you have to understand, logic has nothing to do with what now passes for law. And he's right. So you got people saying, oh, well, if the Supreme Court talks about licenses and making up new rights out of whole cloth, and they say that the 14th Amendment says you have to acknowledge licenses from another state, wouldn't it be logical to say that the same thing would apply to concealed carry? And the answer is, well, yeah. But if that was the case, you'd think shall not be infringed would have had something to do with it, too. So don't kid yourself. If they can get rid of all the old rights in genuine print there, keep and bear arms, freedom of assembly, worship, you know, you name it. Don't even ask me about warrants. Why can't they just ignore anything that they don't like? And they have been and they will. So it's a great way to remind ourselves of the fact that this weekend is the time where once upon a time the founders of this country actually said, hey, here's an interesting concept. We agree unanimously that there are certain things that are just plain in your face, undeniably obvious. They said it this way: we hold these truths to be self-evident. And basically, what's self-evident? Well, the Torah says one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. The Torah talks about all kinds of things. Essentially, it's about law. And it says that there is a creator, and that the creator endowed all kinds of people, all of them, with certain unalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and property, and that the point of government is to secure these rights. Well, folks, that was then, this is now. Because if you go through the list of indictments there, and I'll do this over the weekend, every single thing that King George was doing that was nasty and evil, and basically, as they put it, whose every act may define, literally, a tyrant. Well, such a person, such a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. And I guess I'd have to just say King George was a piker compared to the kind of things that the modern technology state is doing to its slaves. So be aware of it. Be watchful. And I'll introduce where I'm going to go after the song that's coming up by just reminding you that this week's Torah portion is called Balak. Balak. No, not Barak. But this Balak was king of Moab, and we got a new Barak that at least seems to be a spiritual heir. And if you think about the king of Moab, there's a whole lot of parallels there. All right, well, let's talk about the Torah portion for tonight. And while I'm getting my light set up here, because it's not quite dark yet, but it will be in a little while, turn with me, if you will, to the book of Numbers, the Midbar in the Wilderness, chapter 22, 22 in the Spanish. And here we go. Begins like this. It actually starts in verse 2, after the journey of the children to the plains of Moab, beyond the Jordan, not too far from Jericho. Says here that Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Now, remember, these basically are people in the land. The Moabites are the descendants of Lot through the incest with his two daughters, and Balak is the king of the Moabites. And they are a little bit upset at what the Israelites are doing, so they have decided that what they're going to do is gang up together and figure out some way to fix them somehow. Verse 3 says, Moab was sore afraid of the people because there were so many of them. Moab was overcome with dread because of the children of Israel. And so basically, he went and he said, all right, going to make a spiritual war here on these folks, the children of Israel. And he went looking for basically the televangelist preacher extraordinaire of the day. And this guy had quite a reputation among the pagans in particular. Baal Peor. There are some people that suggest that he's the son of Beor, and it may just be a reference to Peor indirectly. But you know that the pagan god that was a big deal in the land was Baal Peor. And they sent these messengers to Balaam to see if they could get him to come and curse these folks. All right, now there I'm going to pause. And I'll make an admission, and that's kind of what I alluded to. I just can't help it. As I was looking at this and reading the Torah portion this week and thinking of Balak of Moab, your mind just kind of wants to go there, doesn't it? Balak Obama. It's not just a rhyme. It's the parallels here that caused me to decide to put the news up front. Because what we're talking about is Balak, a king of Moab, a land that basically was a place of a whole lot of, is there a polite way to put this? Incestuous and other kinds of stuff. Things that were offensive to the king of the universe. So you've got a king of Moab that is literally dead set on trying to get a whole bunch of people cursed because they follow the Torah of Yah. Oh, and think of it this way, too. They're also armed. He sees them as a real threat. Little does he know, the real strength is bigger than their arms. So I guess when I look at that and think, okay, do we have any parallels today with a king who certainly has a lot more spiritually in common with Moab than he does with anything associated with the United States? And he seems also dead set on making sure that anybody that is a follower of the Torah of Yah or the God of the Bible or anything even remotely that sounds like it is not welcome. Let me cut to the chase. Remember the end of the story? This is actually not even in the Torah portion. But you find out later that when Balaam was unable, because God kept telling him, here's what you're allowed to do and here's what you're not. All right. Well, when all was said and done, and we'll go through the specifics in a minute, he figured another end around. I don't know how I can get him. We'll use sex. That always works. And that's exactly what they did. And isn't that amazing? It's exactly what's happening today with the new Moabites and their king. All right, let's go back. Let's pick up the story. Now this is a funny story, you could do it as stand-up comedy almost. I've told it a number of times. Most of you have heard me tell it, so I'll probably abbreviate. We'll do it a little bit differently than we have in the past. But nevertheless, if you haven't heard it, it's a good enough story that I have to do it justice. All right, so we'll try to make it a little bit different at least, but still go through all the highlights here. These messengers go to this fellow, Balaam, again, kind of the televangelist of the day. He has a reputation as being a true prophet. So come now, therefore, they ask Balaam, and curse these folks for me. They are too mighty for me. Maybe we can prevail. Maybe I can prevail. Smite them. Drive them out of the land. Because I know, says Balak, listen to this, that whom you bless is blessed, and whom you curse is cursed. Wait a minute. Isn't that what the Bible says about somebody different than Balaam? It's talking about those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. It was a reference to Abraham from Genesis. So it's kind of a twisting of that. Anyway, they got all kinds of stuff. They're going to bribe Balaam, and they seem to think that'll work, and they probably have pretty good reason for believing that. And he says to them, hey, you all stay here tonight. I'll bring back some word on whether or not Yahuwah will speak to me. So these various princes of Moab, they stayed there with Balaam, and Elohim, it says, came to Balaam and asked a question. Now this too is funny. Who are these men with you? Stop. I mean, you know darn well he knows, right? Why would the king of the universe and creator ask a question like that? This is a question that Rashi asks, goes into a lot of detail with the language, and basically what he suggests, and I think it makes pretty good sense, is just like Pharaoh was allowed to make his own bed, and then eventually he found that, he can harden his own heart for a while, but eventually his heart's going to get hardened for him, that Balaam, too, has a choice here. And we kind of know his character. I suspect Elohim knows his character as well, and is essentially allowing him to create a trap of his own devising and then step in it. In other words, is this God not really all that omnipotent as I think? He doesn't really know. Why does he have to ask me this question? Well, again, there's a lot of speculation involved in understanding that, but nevertheless, Torah points out for us that Elohim does ask this question. Who are these men? And Balaam says unto Elohim, this is Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab. And he's telling me all this stuff about these people that you brought up out of Egypt, and so he's asked me to curse them for him, so he can fight them and drive them out. And here is where the first command, direct from Elohim, comes to Balaam. He says, you are not to go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. Now, I ask the question here. If I have a puppy dog and I say, do not do this, is he without excuse for not understanding the clear instruction? Is Balaam, in other words, not pretty clearly being instructed here as to what he is and is not to do? You're not to go with them, and you are not to curse the people, for they are blessed. It seems pretty straightforward. So he rises up in the morning, and he says to the princes of Balak, oh, go into your land, go back home, because Yahuwah refused to give me leave to go with you. Because he isn't letting me go. All right, he could run for Congress. He certainly would fit in on most news coverage, because he basically has told at least a partial truth here. He soft-pedaled it. He certainly didn't come out with the whole thing. No, I'm not allowed to go with you, period, and I'm not allowed to curse the people. That's what he said. What it sounds like is, well, he won't let me go. So they went back, they told Balak that. And this time he decides, well, that doesn't sound too much like the door is shut. He sends some more honorable princes back with another offer. And they said to Balaam, this time, here is Balak, son of Zippor, saying, let nothing, I pray you, hinder you from coming on and doing this thing for me. I'll promote you with very great honor. Anything you ask, I'll give you. Come, therefore, and curse these folks for me. Well, does this sound like negotiation to you? It does to me when I read this. Even if you gave me your whole house full of silver and gold. No, I just can't see my way clear to go beyond what Yahuwah, my Elohim, has said. To do anything, small or great. This is a true politician. You can't argue with the fact that he is at least paying lip service to what he's been told. But you can kind of tell that his heart isn't in it. That's putting it mildly. So, he says, now listen to this. So y'all just stay here tonight. So, because I'll check it out again. You know, I do think it at least makes perfectly good sense to go back and ask one more time, since you've put it so nicely. So you stay here that I may know what Yahuwah will speak to me anymore. It's not like he hasn't already gotten a pretty darned unequivocal answer. So, Elohim comes to Balaam at night, and he says to him, if the men come to call you, then rise up and go with them, knowing full well that that's not what's going to happen. Isn't that cute? But only the words which I speak to you, that is the thing you are to do. Going to keep him on a short list, on a short leash. So, Balaam rose up in the morning, he saddled his ass, and he went with the princes of Moab. Huh? Say what? Where does it say the princes of Moab came to him in the morning? He got up, saddled his ass, and he's ready to go. He's rip-roaring ready. The sages will point out, by the way, that if you remember these parallels with the story of Abraham, it really is kind of interesting. This is the one that's real obvious. There are a number of them in here that sound a lot like the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, where Abraham gets up in the morning, he saddles his ass, and he's fixing to go up to the mountain to make a burned offering of his son, his only son. Back to verse 22, where it says, Elohim's anger was kindled because he went. And he sent a messenger, Malak, of Yahuwah, who placed himself in the way. And it says here, as an adversary against him. And if you look in the Hebrew, it really says, Le Satan. The word we get the word Satan from in English is Satan, or adversary. So he has put an adversary in the way. Now he's riding upon his ass. Two servants were with him. Again, another parallel to Abraham, who had two servants with him as well. By the way, just for those of you that are curious, yes, the word ass is in here, and an ass is a female donkey. And the ass, it says, saw Melech Yahuwah standing in the way. Malak Yahuwah, standing in the way. And he had his sword drawn in his hand. And this ass is a lot smarter than Balaam, because the ass turns aside out of the way. He goes into the field. And Balaam doesn't know what's going on here. He smote her to turn her back again to the way. So the Malak of Yahuwah stands now in a little bit narrower pass, a hollow way between two vineyards, with a fence on one side and a fence on the other side. Now this time the ass sees the messenger again. And this time she decides that she's going to try to make a more definite opinion. She crushes Balaam's foot against the wall. Bang, 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 bang. He smites her again. Next pass. The angel, the Malak of Yahuwah, stands in a narrow place. Now it's narrow enough that there's no way around. No way to turn either to the right hand or to the left. And the ass, it says, saw the Malak Yahuwah, and she laid down. Just plain went down on all fours. And Balaam's anger was kindled, and he smote her with his staff. And at this point, we have one of the more, it does demonstrate that the creator and author of Scripture has a sense of humor. He is essentially saying, you think you're a prophet? I got an ass that's smarter than you. And he opens her mouth. And now the ass literally speaks to the prophet of Baal, and he says, what have I done to you that you've now smitten me these three times? Does it strike you like it does me, just a little bit funny, that this doesn't even faze Balaam? He starts talking right back. This happens all the time. He says to the ass, because you have mocked me. If there was a sword in my hand, by golly, I would kill you right here. So the ass is not having any of that. She says to Balaam, am I not your ass? Upon you've ridden all your life long to this very day? Have I ever done anything even remotely like this before? Well, no, come to think of it, you haven't. Is there a message here? So Yahuwah opens the eyes of Balaam. He sees the Malak Le Yahuwah standing there in the pass with his sword drawn in his hand. And at this point, finally, this person who has now been shown by his ass exactly what is going on falls on his face. And the angel of Yahuwah said to him, why have you smitten your ass these three times? Behold, here I am. I stand before you as Satan, an adversary, because your way is contrary to me. And even your ass saw me, turned aside before me these three times. If she had not done that, I would have killed you by now. Know that, and saved her alive. So Balaam said to the angel, the messenger of Yahuwah, I have sinned, for I didn't know that you stood in the way. So if it displeases you, I'll head on back now. Nope, says the messenger, go with the men, but... Now listen carefully. He doesn't say it this way. This is me emphasizing what the text says. Let me read it specifically. Go with the men, but only the word that I shall speak unto you, that you shall speak. Are we clear? You got it yet? So Balaam went with the princes of Balak. Balak hears all about this, and he go out to meet him at a place called Ir Moab on the border of Arnon, the utmost part. And he says there to the prophet, didn't I earnestly send unto you to call you? Why didn't you come? I could give you all kinds of good stuff, right? Balaam says to Balak, lo, I have come. But have I now any power to speak anything? The word that Elohim puts in my mouth, that is what I shall speak. So they basically go through this. I'm not going to read all of the specifics, but they go to three places, and they do a little thing three times. First place they go is Kiriat Huzot. And there Balak sacrifice oxen and sheep, and he sends to Balaam, and they brought him up to the mouth, to the top of Bamoth Baal, and from thence to the utmost part of the people, and he says, okay, look out here. Build me seven altars. Prepare seven bulls, seven rams. Balak did About, I think I got that backwards. Anyway, this is the prophet speaking to the king. And the king did as Balaam had asked him to do, and on every altar they offered a bull and a ram. Stand by. I'm going to go see if Yahuwah will come meet me. Whatever he shows me, I'll tell you. So he went to a bare spot on the hill, and Elohim met with Balaam there, and he said unto him, I got you these seven altars, bull and a ram on each one. And Yahuwah put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, here's what you're going to tell him. Go on back. He took up his parable and said, from Aram Balak bringeth me, the king of Moab from the mountains of the east. Come, curse me, Jacob, and execrate Israel. And the response, how shall I curse whom Elohim has not cursed? How shall I execrate whom Yahuwah has not execrated? From the top of the rocks I see him, from the hills I behold him. Lo, it's a people that shall dwell alone, shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who has counted the dust of Jacob or numbered the stock of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my end be like his. That sound like a curse to you? What have you done to me, says the king? I told you to curse my enemies, and sounds like you have blessed them here. And Balaam says, hey, aren't I supposed to take heed to speak that which Yahuwah puts in my mouth? All right. I get it. Okay, so let's go somewhere else. You can take them, you can check them out from another vantage point. You can curse them from there. All right, well, you know, a lot of good money here at stake. So they go to another place. They do the same deal with the burnt offering. Yahuwah comes to Balaam, puts a word in his mouth and says, here you go back to Balak, tell him this. Hey, what's he said when he gets back? Elohim is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should make teshuva repent. When he has said, won't he go and do exactly that? Or what he has spoken, will he not make it good? Behold, I am bidden to bless, and when he is blessed, I cannot call it back. None has beheld iniquity in Yaakov, nor has one seen perverseness in Israel. Yahuwah, his Elohim, is with him. And the shouting for the king is among them. Elohim who brought them forth out of Egypt is for them like the lofty horns of the wild ox. There's no enchantment, unlike you guys, with Yaakov, nor is there any divination with Israel. Now it is said of Israel and of Yaakov, what hath God wrought? By the way, that's the same thing Abraham... I hate it when this happens. Ma Bell, inventor of the telephone. Alexander Graham Bell. That's not it. I got it wrong. It was Morse. Samuel F.B. Morse. First words typed on the Morse code when they first made the transmission was, what hath God wrought? Just a little aside there for you. Behold, here's a people that rise up as a lioness, and as a lion he lifts himself up. He doesn't lie down until he eats of the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. Oh, don't curse him or don't bless him at all, is what the king's response is to that. Once again, Balaam says, look, didn't I tell you what he speaks, that I must do? Okay. Let's go yet one more place. We'll go to a third place. Maybe you can curse him from there. It almost, you kind of wonder where Dr. Seuss gets it. Shall I curse them on a house? Shall I curse them with a mouse? If you'll take me somewhere else, won't I curse them from there? Well, this time they're going to go back to Peor, the place of Baal Peor. Looks down upon the desert, the very home of Baal worship itself. And Balaam says to Balak, okay, let's do it again. Seven more altars, seven bulls, seven rams. Balak did what he was told, and they offered up a bull and ram on every altar. And when Balaam said that it pleased Yahuwah to bless Israel, he didn't go to meet with enchantments, but he set his face towards the wilderness. He lifted up his eyes. He saw Israel dwelling tribe by tribe. And the spirit of Elohim came upon him. He took up his parable, and he said, the saying of Balaam, son of Beor, and the saying of the man whose eye is opened, the saying of him who hears the words of Elohim, who sees the vision of the Almighty, fallen down, yet with opened eyes. As valleys stretched out, as gardens by the riverside, as aloes planted by Yahuwah, as cedars beside the waters. Water shall flow from his branches, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. You can kind of hear the tone here. This does not yet sound like a curse either, does it? Matter of fact, this is going to be one of the most famous blessings in Scripture. Elohim, who brought him forth out of Egypt, is for him like the lofty horns of the wild ox. He shall eat up the nations that are his adversaries, break their bones in pieces, and pierce them through with his arrows. Hey, how's that grabbing you, Balak? You liking this? He crouched, he lay down as a lion, and as a lioness, who shall rouse him up? Blessed be every one that blesses you, and cursed be every one that curses you. Now, at this point, I'm going to pause, because you know what verse 10 is going to say. Balak is not happy. He's 0 for 3. He smote his hands together, and he says, look, I called you. Oh, come on, man. I called you to curse my enemies. And here you go. You have blessed them, not once, not twice, three times. And it's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh's fault that he has kept you back from the honor that you were due. So there's a little bit of irony here. Hey, didn't I tell you when you sent your messengers? Didn't I tell you what was going to happen here? Now, let's pause there for a second. Because there is an end to the story. And we know that at this point, at least, it sounds like Bilaam is a pretty good prophet. He has done precisely what, well, finally having met with an angel that was literally getting ready to smite him on the trail, he seems to have gotten the message. But I want to point out a couple things. And I saw a nice presentation. I've mentioned before, I like David Foreman. He has gone through kind of extensively all of these parallels between Abraham and Bilaam. And, of course, there's a little bit of twisting in there, too. But you can see, and we've already mentioned several of them. What is really kind of fascinating to me is what we have here, as you see the story, are three mountains, three attempts at curses, all of which turn into three different blessings, and they're all parallel to the promises of Abraham. And if you're writing them down, I've got them listed here. It's Numbers 23:10, that was the first one, then Numbers 23:24, and then 24:9. We just mentioned verse 24:9, where, you know, the blessed be all those that bless you, cursed everyone that curses you. Now, there's another couple of things that we remember about Abraham. Certainly that one sticks out, right? Your seed will be great in multitudes of them. All the families of Haaretz literally will be blessed in you. And it looks like, says David Foreman, that when you follow this pattern of threes here with Numbers 23:10 and 23:24 and the blessings that come from curses and so forth, that even the blessings seem to be patterned after Abraham. And yet, this third one breaks the pattern. It's a different blessing for Abraham. In other words, it's not the one that says all the families of Haaretz will be blessed in you. It's an earlier one that's out of sequence about, those who bless you will be blessed, those who curse you will be cursed, from Genesis 12. And here is a place where I'm going to just kind of hearken back to something I've been saying several times over the last few weeks. Isn't it interesting that the pattern is now changed? I said it before, I blame Moshe for some of this. Now, I understand, I'm not blaming Moshe in that sense, but certainly Moshe, if you will, there was a pattern that seemed to be laid out in Torah. And it certainly looks to me like when he struck the rock twice, rather than speaking to the rock once like he was supposed to, certain things just didn't pan out. So how is it that through Abraham all the families of the earth will be blessed? Well, we know that the line of Mashiach comes through Abraham. That's an obvious one. The blessing of Kol Haaretz, all of the earth, comes through that. And I got this highlighted and underlined, and I'm going to put it this way. Did you notice that last blessing about Israel? That'll eat up all the nations that are his adversaries, break their bones in pieces, pierce them through with arrows, like a lion, and as a lioness, who shall rouse him up? Then it says, blessed be everyone that blesses you, curse those that curse you. The whole point here was Balak being concerned that these people were going to come into the land and do exactly that to him. Israel brings a sword. And the sword that comes through the line here is the sword of the Word. When I read that, I guess that's kind of how all of this seems to play out to me. Speak what I tell you to speak. This is the message of the prophet. We got all kinds of warnings in Torah about prophets that don't speak the things that they are told to speak. Even Balak, a pagan, speaks what he is told to speak. He doesn't necessarily do so out of the fullness of his heart. He kind of has to be dragged to it, kicking and screaming and being given real clear instructions, or he wouldn't. There's a whole lot of other stuff. A lot of times I'll frequently mention things that are in the Midrash, I think, that are... sometimes they're not, to my mind, supported well enough from Scripture to say that they're necessarily true. But at least this one is interesting. You will hear in the Talmud and various other kinds of Midrashic sources, you will hear the claim made that Balaam is kind of like Moshe for the pagans. Okay? Israel has Moses, and the pagans have Balaam. And the claim that they'll make is, well, you see, here is the reason. Because that way the pagans can't use an excuse, say, look, you guys had Moses. Come on, you got this great prophet, Moses. But we didn't have one like that. And that, therefore, they got Balaam. All right, it's an interesting case. I'm not sure if I completely buy it. But at least that is part of the other side of the story here. They'll also point out to you that if you look at this story, in this particular part of the Torah, it's very different than most of the other stories we see in the Torah. Because it's told from the viewpoint of the pagans themselves. Right? We're kind of seeing a behind the scenes. Here's what the pagans say when they're off by themselves. Here's Balak talking to Balaam, the prophet for hire. So it's an interesting aside, it's an interesting observation, and I think for that reason this set of parallels between Abraham and between Balaam and even some of the things that are compare and contrast with Moses are at least, let's just say, educational to us. And that leads me to, I guess, the end of the story. Now this, again, is not the part that appears in the Torah portion, but I think it'll set up what we're going to talk about next week. The story of Pinchas, Phinehas, and what happens there. And it certainly looks like, we don't know exactly the timing, but kind of sort of we do. Looks like at the end of the story, something else happens right away. So let's finish the story, see if it doesn't make sense. Balaam is upset. He doesn't get his honor. And he tells Balak exactly what he was told to say. Look, I told you guys that even if they gave me all kinds of money, I got to speak what I got to speak. So behold, now I'm going to go to my folks, my people, and I'll announce to you what this people shall do to your people in the end of days. He took up his parable and he said, the saying of the son of Beor, Balaam, the saying of the man whose eyes opened, the saying of him who hears the words of Elohim and knows the knowledge of the Most High, sees the vision of the Almighty, fallen down, yet with opened eyes. That sounds to me at least like, could be a number of things, but certainly kind of describes the scene in front of the angel and the donkey, the ass. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not nigh. There shall step forth a star out of Yaakov, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite through the corners of Moab, and break down all the sons of Set. And Edom shall be a possession, Seir also, even his enemy shall be a possession, while Israel does valiantly. And out of Yaakov shall one have dominion, and destroy the remnant of the city. Maimonides points out that there are at least a couple of things that he sees in here. And it's interesting to me when somebody like Maimonides kind of goes partway towards saying, Well, essentially what he says is there's one reference to King David in here and another reference to the coming Mashiach in there. Just that he doesn't quite see that it's a Mashiach that came 2,000 years ago. And he looked on Amalek, continues the prophecy, and took up his parable, and he said, remember, Amalek is the one that Torah talks about how the people of Israel are going to make continual war on Amalek. Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall come to destruction. He looked on the Kenite, took up his parable, and said, oh, firm be your dwelling place, and though your nest be set in the rock, nevertheless Cain shall be wasted. How long? Asher shall take you away captive. Alas, he said, who shall live after God has appointed him? Ships will come from the coast of Kittim. They shall affect Asher, afflict Eber, and he too are all going to come to destruction. Not exactly a great way to end it, right? So far as Balak and all of those folks that were looking for something different are concerned. So Balaam rose up. He went. He returned to his place. Balak goes home too. Looks like that's the end of the story, right? But it doesn't seem to be. We see a number of references. Matter of fact, Balaam appears a whole bunch of places in the Tanakh. He shows up in the book of Deuteronomy. He shows up again in just a few chapters, Numbers 31:16. And it's Numbers 31:16 as well as the commentary of Moshe in Deuteronomy that kind of gives you a bit more of the story, what Balaam does. And I've already alluded to it, but it goes like this. His heart was not necessarily in doing what he did here. And he seems to me like a conniver. Matter of fact, one of the things you will hear referred to, Balaam, they will call Balaam ha-Rasha. He's one of the more evil figures in the Torah, is the popular understanding of Balaam. He is ha-Rasha. The bad dude, the evil one. And why? Doesn't seem like, and at least here, that concept holds as much water. Like he's getting a bad rap. Well, let's turn to 31:16. We'll read this out of sequence. Moshe is talking to these folks a little while on down the line here, and he says, talking about a bunch of women, and these women got Israel into trouble. Behold, says Moshe, these people called the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to revolt so as to break faith with Yahuwah in the matter of Peor and caused a plague. Okay, what really went on, and Scripture does pretty well paint this picture, not just here but in a couple other places. Balaam said, look here, if you can't get them via the front door, get them via the back door. See if we can't get women to bring them to a place of where they will curse themselves. And by the way, this is where I hearken back again to Barack Obama of modern Moab. See if we can get them to curse themselves. See if we can get them to turn their back on the thing that the creator of the universe calls marriage, sign up for another master, take his license, both for their so-called churches and for their so-called marriages, and turn it into something that the creator of the universe calls abomination. We'll force them to drink deep from that particular poisoned well. Boy, the parallels here, at least to me, speak volumes. So what Balaam did was encourage the Moabite women, go out and entice those Israelite guys into all kinds of good sex. And if you can get them there, well, you can probably get them to follow you on into the various pagan temples and really tie the ribbons on it. I can't curse them, but they can curse themselves. And that really does seem to be the end of the story. And if you put it that way and understand it, then perhaps Balaam ha-Rasha, the evil, really does make sense. Of course, could be that it just depends on what the meaning of the word is too. We got lots of politicians, folks, that have managed to come up with ways to make an end around the law and around the instruction of Yah. I guess ultimately there is nothing new in what's going on today. I guess that's part of what I want to make clear here. Chapter 25 is the end of the portion, just first 9 verses here, and it tells a little bit of what is fixing to happen next. And it does make sense. If you understand Balaam goes away, but it would appear that he gave some pretty, disgustingly effective advice. Israel, it says, abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people unto the sacrifices of their bogus, fake, so-called Elohim gods. And the people ate, and they bowed down to their gods, and Israel joined himself unto Baal of Peor. There you go. And the anger of Yahuwah was kindled against Israel. Wonder if they had rainbow flags. No, that's something else, right? You take a symbol that the creator of the universe uses to say, here is my bow in the sky serving as a sign of the covenant. And I guess if you're going to twist everything that he talks about in the way of covenant and marriage and turn that into an abomination, why not take the symbol of he will not destroy the world with water anymore and turn that into an abomination too? Yeah, it all fits. Yahuwah said unto Moshe, take the chiefs of all the people, hang them up unto Yahuwah in the face of the sun, so that the fierce anger of Yahuwah may turn away from Israel. Literally, flaring of the nose here is the Hebrew phrase that's used. Moshe says to the judges of Israel, slay you, every one of these men that have joined themselves to this fake god, Baal Peor. And here we go. One of the children of Israel came and brought into, literally, in the sight of all of the people, a Midianitish woman, the sight of Moses, in the sight of all the congregation of all of B'nai Israel, children of Israel, while they are sitting there weeping at the door of the tent of meeting. Pinhas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, sees it. He rises up from the midst of the congregation. He fixes the problem, boldly even. Took a spear in his hand, he went in after the man of Israel into the chamber where he was doing the dirty deed, and he thrust them both through the back of one into the front of the other, through the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. What was the death toll here? Those that died by the plague were 24,000. Now, it's a funny place to end. We'll probably end up having to pick that story up again next week, because literally that's kind of sort of the middle of this story of Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, who did this amazing thing. And it, too, is a little bit problematic in terms of the fact that, his zeal literally led him to slay this bad guy who was committing an abomination in the sight of all of the children of Israel. But that is where we will pause. We'll leave it there this week. And just, again, kind of point out that, a story seen from a pagan vantage point about, an ancient televangelist, in a way, who really wants to curse people, does seem to have a genuine connection. He actually does hear from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Tends to want to ignore it, but nevertheless, when he is given a suitable encounter with a near-death experience, he gets the message. But when all is said and done, his true colors still show through. There's a sword here, and the sword is the word. And I guess, to my mind, that's the real message. I do want to read one other thing, just because it's a great way to close for tonight. This is the Haftorah portion, and it also has a little bit to do with the story, as you might expect. Comes from the book of the prophet Micah. And basically, it's chapters 5 into 6. And it talks about, up front in chapter 5, the remnant of Jacob, of Yaakov, shall be among the Goyim, the nations, in the midst of many peoples. To my mind, while that applies to a number of places in history, it certainly does also seem to apply today. Like a lion among the beasts of the forest, it says, treads down and tears in pieces, none can deliver. So it's talking about a time foretold, and a lot of people will interpret this to say, yeah, this is also about the coming of Mashiach. Chapter 5, Elohim, or chapter 6, the next part of this. Hear now what Yahuwah says. Arise, plead your case before the mountains. O my people, what have I done to you? Asks Yahuwah. How have I wearied you? Remember, he says, what Balak, king of Moab, counseled, and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered him. All of these things, so that you might know the righteousness of Yahuwah. And then this Haftorah portion ends with this verse. It's a great verse. I love this. Nice way to close for this evening. He has shown you, says the prophet, O man, what is good. And what does Yahuwah require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God.